Welcome to Interplay Conversations in Music. This is Michael Shapiro with my special guest, Maestro Donato Cabrera from very warmer California. I'm calling you from very frigid New York. Donato, how are you?
Wonderful, Michael. Thank you so much for your invitation. I'm really excited to speak with you
Thank you.
And have this time together.
Oh, this is wonderful. And hopefully we can meet together physically at some point, Donato. You know, when we look at your work over these years now, we can talk about a body of work with California and California Symphony near San Francisco and also the Las Vegas Philharmonic and many other orchestras throughout the world. The thing that I find about your conducting is its wonderful innate musicianship and the fact that there's not a gesture that you do that is not tied to the score. So.
Well, Michael, thank you. Gosh, that's a wonderful compliment, and it's something that. And thank you for recognizing that, because that is, while I don't feel I am always successful achieving that, that is indeed my primary goal. I think for all of us, for conductors who have the opportunity to conduct as much as we do. Necessity is a mother of invention in many ways, and I learned that being efficient, being communicative with the least physicality but with the most intention, I learned that on the first day of my real full-time professional job, which was as resident conductor of the San Francisco Opera. I was brought in 2005, speaking of body of time flies, but I was brought in 2005 to be the resident conductor. My very first production was the world premiere of John Adams' Dr. Atomic. And the first 2.5 weeks, the then music director, my boss, Donald Runicles, was not there. So it was me and the cast, and John would sit on my left, and Peter Sellers, the director, would sit on my right. And at that time at San Francisco Opera, there was no company-wide dark day. That has since changed, and now every production must have the dark day on Monday. But at that point, all the productions had their own dark day, which was wonderful for the cast and crew, right, for Dr. Atomic. But because I was the only conductor, I had no dark day. Everyone else had, there were other pianists that could, there were three or four pianists that were assigned that could rotate. And of course the cast had a cover cast, but for the first 28 days,
right,
I conducted 6 hours a day. Straight. Well, there was our lunch. And after day three, I woke up and I really couldn't turn my head to the right any longer.
I understand.
And so what that taught me, again, because I had no other option, was that I needed to just think about the music and be efficient. And that really has carried with me for the rest. It was an incredible lesson, because at the same time, I was so lucky. I was working with the greatest singers in the world, with pianists, as you know, these great pianists in the opera houses. They can, their job is to sound like an orchestra and to follow you like an orchestra would follow you. So during these hours upon hours of staging rehearsals, I had at my disposal these incredible musicians to work with and to experiment with. Okay, I can't do what I normally do, which obviously was too much to begin with. So let's figure out a way to be efficient and economical and musical.
I saw that score, by the way, at the Met when it was done.
Ah, I was there. I was the assistant conductor for that production.
Right. Now, let's talk about, for those conductors, young conductors watching this, you really should see Maestro Cabrera's work if you can see it live, even better. But when you could see him face, see the camera looking at his face rather than from the back, you can see what he does. I remember when I studied conducting with Harold Farberman over 20 years ago at Bard. He used to talk about the score, and from the score comes the motion, as
Absolutely.
opposed to, you know.
That's right. I mean, it's a very again, I think it does it must out of repetition, and again, I mean repetition by having the wonderful honor of rehearsing for often and day in, day out. If you just wave your arms around without any meaning, you're not going to get any results. Most importantly, the thing you're supposed to be there for, you become useless. And musicians, whether and it doesn't matter what form they've come in, whether they're singers, pianists, orchestras, they will even, I think I would say, subconsciously check out if a conductor gets in front of them and merely beats time. Well, how we all learn how to beat time, the basic patterns, of course. But if we never connect those beats, those in physical impulses with musical meaning or philosophical meaning or emotion, again, all tied to what we learn while we're studying this music and reading about it. If we don't connect it to any impulse, it's you. They're literally meaningless.
There are so many people who do that and don't connect to the organic purpose of the music. It drives this composer nuts. I come to conducting from the composition state, you know. I mostly conduct my own stuff, although I had 16 years doing standard rep when I conducted in Chappaqua and other places. But it just drives me nuts to see people who don't organically understand the score. So, you know.
I think there's also one can not to defend those folks, but I would also argue that one of the challenges of conducting is that, again, this should also teach us to be minimal, is that the more you move physically, the more one moves, the less one hears. It's human nature. It goes back to the flight or fright aspect of our inner caveman, that the moment we start moving, all of our brain starts focusing on what we're seeing and less about what we're hearing, because we had to escape those saber-toothed tigers and be ultra aware of what we're looking at, not necessarily of what we're hearing. And so the more one moves, by nature, we hear less. So I know there are many well-meaning conductors that are so well prepared. They really have been at home and they've studied the music and they are really going in there with the best intentions, but they're faced with this dichotomy. The moment they stand on podium, they start moving and conducting, and they may not be comfortable yet with these gestures, or even if they are comfortable, they feel that they need to conduct a certain way, and they stop listening
This is
because of human nature.
fascinating. All right. So now I'm going to jump right on that comment and think about history. Carlos Kleiber was famous for watching videos of the great conductors. He'd love to study them. He did it all the time. And people would send him, like, videos. Maybe it was, I'm not sure the form, but I'm assuming it was a VHS in those days. And let's look at Fritz Reiner and his student Leonard Bernstein, which I often find very interesting. I didn't know Reiner, but I knew Lenny. And the interesting thing about Bernstein was, in rehearsals, he was a perfectionist, which he got from his Curtis training, not only with Reiner, but with my teacher too, René Longy, the whole idea of precision. But in his mind, you could do anything to get that precise gesture. Now, this kind of If you think of somebody listening, you think of Fritz Reiner or George Sell, who are very stationary, didn't really move much. I mean, Reiner was, Richard Strauss was even worse, except when he was looking at his watch to figure out when the card game was. But
That's right.
you know that famous story. So, but Reiner, the com, you know, it's so tiny what he's doing. And it's this kind of telepathy. While Lenny's all over the place. I mean, I saw Lenny in the 60s and then again in the 80s. And, you know, when he was younger and he could physically move more in the 60s. But he was all over the map. But he was listening like nobody's business. I know that.
I think with Leonard Bernstein, and I'm reminded of this because I've just now started to read the his letters
Yeah,
that were published about 15 years ago or so,
it's interesting.
and I love the early letters because you really get a sense, first of all, especially to his school chums, because you get a sense of him as a real person, not as this incredible.
Yeah, of course.
But you sense that he not only had enormous respect for Fritz Reiner, and totally in awe of what he was doing, because he would go see him conduct, the New York Philharmonic, and then the next day he'd do Der Rosenkavalier at the Met, and so this not only as his teacher in Philadelphia, but as a performer in New York City, Leonard Bernstein had a real wonderful way of observing like this. Not only, a lot of teachers only show you in class. They very few teachers are on the world stage exhibiting exactly what they're showing you day in, day out. So he had that he had this model that he obviously didn't follow in terms of gesture.
Not at all.
But equally important to Leonard Bernstein's development, and what is so wonderful about him was that he was at the same time under the tutelage or mentorship of Serge Koussevitzky in Boston, who was this incredible Dionysian, all about emotion conductor. I love watching the videos, especially between the two, Reiner and Koussevitzky, who again couldn't be more different. And Bernstein was able, as you said so beautifully, he was able to be both if he needed to be, both at the same time, and one or the other, depending on the situation in rehearsal. And also another very important mentor to Bernstein was Dmitri Mitropoulos, again another incredibly volcanic emotional conductor.
Metropolis got up at 5 a.m. every morning to memorize, and he very much deeply went into score study. I'm curious about your background. Did you study composition at all?
I did not through I never I didn't get a degree in composition, but my exposure to classical music was I grew up in Reno, Nevada. On the one hand, for a small western town, it had an incredibly vibrant, still does, art scene, especially music scene. So I had decent examples and wonderful teachers, but my journey began with classical music when I was 15 with my best friend. He played bassoon, I played French horn. He immediately started becoming interested in composition. I became interested in conducting, and somehow we both ended up doing what we loved. He became a composer and taught at Washington State up until just last year, and taught bassoon, and I became a conductor. I no longer played a French horn, but we discovered music in this wonderful way together on the bus to school, where we would share our discoveries in composition and conducting simultaneously. And I tried to compose. I was nowhere near as good at it as Ryan was, but he would show me some things, and I would show him things about conducting. And so we both had this interest and exposure to conducting and composition in a very healthy, wonderful way.
Let's talk about form. Let's say you're going to conduct a Brahms 2. Why should you be conducting Brahms 2 when there are so many examples in the literature, in the recorded literature, of people who've conducted Brahms too. Why you? And what would you
Well,
bring?
first of all, it's interesting you bring up Brahms' Second Symphony because I will be conducting it this summer in Chile with this orchestra that I'm finally getting to return to since the pandemic.
Right.
And I actually had submitted Symphony Number 1 because I have recently conducted Brahms' Second Symphony quite a few times, and so I didn't want to conduct the Second Symphony. But they came back and they said, "Well, Maestro, we need one of the symphonies, the only symphony that has a tuba in these, again, practical terms,
I know.
is the Second Symphony, and our tuba player needs the services. So we can you please think about?" And so I not reluctant, of course, but it's to answer your question, it's not about me always. It's often about what the orchestra
Oh,
needs
there's no
and
question about that. Well, the
about the audience needs. Now, why should I
what are you
revisit?
bringing to it, Dorado?
Because first of all, these masterworks they're masterworks because of the main reason is that every time you revisit them, you learn something new about the piece and you learn something new about yourself. And the way I approach a piece like Brahms' Second Symphony or a Beethoven Symphony, it constantly is evolving because I'm growing as an artist, I'm growing as a musician, and it would be the same to say that you go to the Louvre and you see David and you say, okay, I've seen it, I don't need to see it any longer. No, because every time you go to Paris, you should try and get in there to that lobby, fight the crowds, and see David every 5 or 10 years, because
You're talking
why?
about Michelangelo David?
Yes.
I'm correcting you. It's in Firenze.
Sorry, I'm thinking of what's the?
You're thinking of the winged victory
Yes,
up
Winged
on the
Victory.
stairs,
Thank you.
which I
Yes.
love.
Yes, thank you. Winged
Anytime.
Victory.
I've been to
You
both.
get but you get the idea, whether
Of
it's
course.
Mona
No,
Lisa,
but I
it's
understand that. But let's talk about Brahms
content.
second for a second, because this is, I find, very interesting. You're a young conductor. You're first going to conduct Brahms second. What's your choice of tempo for the first movement, and how do you find it? Lenny used to talk about that in the music, the tempo comes out. But what are you doing? How are you starting that D C sharp D? Where's it coming from?
Well, for me, I don't think about that. I think about what happens after that. Now, this is something that also Bruno Walter talks about, and also Eric Leinsdorf, is that the tempo of a piece is often, more often than not, at the beginning. It's somewhere in the music later on that it must be at a certain tempo, or that gesture, musical gesture, will either sound too not sound together or not come off or not have the emotional content. So for me, I always think of di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di. That's what I always think. I think about that very that disjunct arpeggiated melody or part of melody that needs time to be played. I don't think of di-da-di. I don't think of that. Because that can be done in a variety of ways successfully, but that moment later on in the movement can really only be done at a certain tempo.
And you, my friend, can phrase like nobody's business, which is a great natural gift. I think a lot of it has to do with breath and about how one connects the pitches. You've said, actually, I saw in a prior interview that when you sometimes approach a piece, you will read perhaps literature or poetry or philosophy of the period or history. So you understand a little bit more about where we come from, as it were.
Well, I definitely believe that helps in terms of phrasing. I often think of language just in its basic formation. So, for instance, speaking of Brahms, going back to Brahms, I don't think of it. I try my best, even though I'm your classic American in that I didn't grow up learning other languages and et cetera, et cetera. So German to me is a language as I've had to struggle with as an adult. But I try my best when I'm studying Brahms to think of the German language and how the German language flows, how it's sung. And that to me starts to reveal the phrasing and in a Brahms symphonic work more often than not.
I studied conducting first with Karl Bamberger at Manus, and he was, Viennese, and we would talk very in great depth about the Brahms pieces because he had a direct line. His teacher was Schenker, who knew Brahms. Okay, and then bum 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 bum. Now, that very moment, I spoke to Bamberger about it. I said, I heard a recording of Karajan. He slows down at the chorale at the end in the Allegro assai. What the hell is going on? He says, you're right. Schenk is walking down the street in Vienna. And he sees Professor Brahms. He says, hello, Professor. Oh, hello, Schenk. He says, in the last movement of the first symphony, jump ba dum ba bum beam ba bum, in einem Takt. In one movement, said Brahms, do not slow down.
Yeah,
I can't make up these stories.
and this is the thing that when you start reading, especially if you start reading the letters of composers and theorists of the day, they reveal so much of how things should be performed because they did it. They were there. They were in contact with these composers. And it's not to say I don't want to take away from composers, excuse me, conductors who may or may not do that. And Carillon was a great conductor. I have a lot of respect for him. But these traditions can often come from, as Furtwängler used to say, a tradition is just another bad performance. Now, I won't go that far, but tradition can start, and you get these traditions, especially in orchestras that play more often. The larger orchestras, they have their own traditions of how things should go, and there's no real reason why they do. They if you were to stop any of this, why do you slow down there? It's like, well, that's just how we do it, and you need to always ask, like, okay, first of all, why do they do that? And if it's something that you can justify for yourself, you should always this when in rehearsal, I believe, have a sense of, hey, this orchestra does things a certain way. There must be a reason. Why are those reasons? And to take those in and or disregard them and still do it the way you wanted to do it. It's always a give and take.
Well, you just said a wonderful thing about the Brahms second with that wonderful melody and how that kind of draws you in. But this is the wonderful thing about your conducting because you're looking for meaning and expressivity, and it comes out of you naturally. You breathe it. I'm curious as a composer asking the question, two questions. First, how do you find new music that turns you on? And it's not just good business, as we say in Brooklyn. And why are a lot of orchestras only hiring composers or commissioning composers to write these short pieces, but they don't want to look at a symphony or a concerto? Two
Okay.
questions.
The first question, I think, is a little easier to answer than the second question. First, for me, when I became the music director of the California Symphony, I was lucky enough to take over as part of this, my duties as music director, the selection and nurturing of their already existing, it's called the Young American Composer in Residence of the California Symphony. And prior to my time there have been wonderful composers have gone through that have had this residency over the years, have gone to wonderful on off to wonderful things. But one of the things that I wanted to introduce to this process was a complete anonymous application procedure. Before, it would have been difficult to do because people would send their literally scores in paper copy, and everything would have had to have been marked out, etc. But online, now everything is online, so everything is sent via PDF. And our wonderful staff, we get over 100. Last application, we had over 180 applicants, and they erased all names, all titles of the song, of the compositions. I don't even look at the reference. So the only thing that I have are the MP3s, which I actually don't really even listen to, but the score and the
Interesting.
music. So what turned?
Very unusual that's being done because a lot of the orchestras are not doing that. Now,
No, they
what about that short biz? We only have a few more minutes, but what about these short pieces? When the Philharmonic commissioned 19 women to write 19 pieces, that they had to be short.
Of course, it's not a commitment to bringing the audience along on a multi-year journey. I'm so lucky because I have a composer for 3 years. So the first piece I almost always ask them, say, listen, you need to write an overture piece that every orchestra can take, because that's what people are asking for. The next pieces you're going to write, however, can be longer if you want. If you want to write a concerto, even if you want to write something that approaches a symphony, I am there for you, because on the other side of the spectrum, they may never have that opportunity again. So that's a very important aspect. But just to answer the first question quickly, what gets me going are the foundations of music, which are counterpoint and melody.
Ah, bravo, signore. That makes me feel very good, having studied 5 years of species counterpoint with Boulanger. So, in any event, I thank you, Donato Cabrera.
Thank you so much, Michael Shapiro. Thank you very much.
This was magnificent being with Maestro Cabrera and learning about everything about him. And it's way too short. I know we could talk for hours in our classical nerddom, but this is just magnificent. Thank you so very, very much.
Absolutely my pleasure.
This is Michael Shapiro for Interplay Conversations in Music. Thank you for joining us.